from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, your father is the glitter and I am the glue. That's what Kelly Corrigan's mother used to tell her about her mother's ability to keep the family together. In her new memoir, Glitter and Glue, Corrigan reflects on her complicated relationship with her mother and what she learned about motherhood when she was a live-in nanny for a widower in Australia and when she eventually had her own children. That's up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based author Kelly Corrigan is the author of The Middle Place and Lift, both New York Times bestsellers, and she's the co-founder of Notes and Words, which is an annual benefit concert for Children's Hospital in Oakland. Her most recent book is called Glitter and Glue, and it's a memoir of her experiences working as a nanny in an Australian home and discovering, through caring for children whose mother had died, the depth and significance of her own relationship with her mother. Kelly Corrigan is a former student of your genial host, and she's had her work appear in O, the Oprah Magazine, Good Housekeeping, and Medium, and she joins us for Forum Second Hour. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Krasny.
Well, it could be Michael now, and by the way...
I don't know. It feels weird, you know, when you grow up with somebody and then you have to switch to going from Dr. Krasny to Michael, and I'll try.
Well, you've been doing some unsolicited kind promotion for me in a TED Talk and an interview with or a conversation with Anna Quinlan. All that's appreciated. I didn't realize I had that kind of impact on your life. So
you were the first professor that I had in grad school. And I, honest to God, I mean, I don't want to start with just gushing, but I have never been in the presence of someone so lucid and articulate. I had never seen anybody do what you were doing on your feet every Wednesday night for 2 hours, just stringing together the most beautiful analysis. And I mean, I kept a running list of words that you used that I didn't know what they meant. I had to go home and look up about 8 or 9 words every single night after class.
And she's not on my payroll. That's very kind, very generous of you. But we're going to talk about your work today, though. I appreciate the generosity of your comments. And right away, you start talking about your mother, even in the prologue of this book, your mother. And you talk about something that I find quite significant, and that is the difference between having a mother who's a friend and having a mother who looks at, well, her job as a guide and her job as being a mother. I think all too often now there's too much emphasis on mothers as friends and even a kind of pressure for mother to be friends, kids wanting their mothers mm-hmm. or their fathers to be their friends.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I mean, one of the things that I admire about my mother is her ability to sustain a life of being unpopular in her own home.
Like not only in her own home, there was some graffiti.
That's right. And widely around the Philadelphia area. But, you know, it's very painful to have your children be angry with you. And I find that I can't tolerate it nearly as long as she could. But if you're going to do the work, they're going to be mad at you. I mean, if you're going to say no to a car, or you're going to make them eat a vegetable, or you're going to want to check their homework, or you're going to want to say they can't hang out with those people unless their parents are home, you're going to be in their way. And if you have these fierce, argumentative, willful kids like we have, and like I was, you're going to be at odds. And it's almost like how long can you stand to have your kid upstairs in their room writing in their journal about how much they hate you and how much they wish Allison's mom was their mom?
Well, what comes across in terms of your own difficulties with your mother, it comes in a very candid admission of stealing. I mean, you found yourself in Sears, and the explanation for this was really a pretty lucid one, to use your word, because you stole because. I mean, teenagers do that and everything. And then the parental disapproval and, you know, being held to have your mother come and essentially find out about this, you recreated that pain very well. But
that was one of the fastest chapters to write in the whole book. And the whole time I was writing it, I was thinking, I don't know why I'm wasting this whole writing session retelling my shoplifting at Sears story, because there's no way my mom's going to let me publish this. And if she doesn't want me to, I'm not going to. It's not worth it to me. And then I sent her the book and she called back and said, "Wow, Callie, it's beautiful." And I thought, oh, my God, you might have just cured our entire relationship with three words.
Because you were holding that guilt all these years. Huh?
I just thought, I can't believe that you're okay with it. And I said, you don't think it's bad that, you know, I have these two daughters, Georgia and Claire, they're 10 and 12. And I said, you don't think it's bad to let them know? And she said, absolutely not. I think it's a warning shot. And I said, and well, at the end of the story, my mom slaps me across the face so hard that my nose bleeds. So I said, and Ma, you're not like worried about the child abuse-y part of it. And
I think she reached those statute of limitations.
That's right. And she said, absolutely not. I think your generation is too afraid to throw a toss a hit.
So did your mother's voice? I mean, you're mimicking it pretty close to the bone there?
I don't know. It may be more of a spiritual imitation than a actual imitation, but it definitely sounds something like this.
Well, she comes across as a very admirable and wonderful woman. Your dad, you know, clearly you love him, but he's kind of like the guy in the background here. He's the cheerleader. He's the guy, you know, the coach and all that sort of thing, who tells you, gives you points and gives you props for just about everything.
Yeah, it's so funny. People say, God, your dad must have been so proud of you when you wrote these books. And I said, oh, my God. It's like the same as if I had cooked a hamburger by myself. It'd be the same level of enthusiasm. Like, God, I love you. Did you write this book? Did you make this hamburger? Fantastic. But my mother is different. You know, she took the job super seriously. He thought that it was just like a gas. Like having kids was just a blast, you know, and like what's not to love about having kids. But part of my realization is that by the time he got home, a lot of the things that are so difficult about having children had been managed away. And so he was getting a very pleasant 1 hour with his kids before bedtime when we were, you know, we had already brawled over who had to take out the trash and who took it out last time and et cetera, et cetera, and forced into the shower. And by the time he came home, we were clean and we smelled good and we had eaten and we were just there to enjoy.
And the fights were mainly with your mother because it was her
Absolutely.
Arena. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in fact, the whole shoplifting story resolves with this very interesting fact that my mother said after all the abuse was over, she said, God, I'm not even going to tell your father about this. I don't think he could handle it. I swear to God, I don't think he could. And I think that's so interesting. Like what does when one parent keeps something from another parent, that's something to be evaluated. Like, there's a reason
significant,
there.
Significant, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when they seem close, like your parents do. Although at one point in the book, you kind of puzzle over their relationship. How did they even get together in the first place?
Yes.
And there's actually a very telling moment also when you write about your mother telling a racy joke and you say, yeah. This is a side of my mother I really didn't know. Or yeah. You hear about her telling a racy joke. And what it comes to a kind of little epiphany about how there are many different people within your mother.
Yes, and, absolutely. And all of us, right? But as children, you're so, I don't know, solipsistic. I think you taught me that word. I swear to God, I think you did. But anyway, you know, it's just everything is only in terms of yourself. I mean, that all that exists is that she's this woman who takes care of you or stands between you and the things you want or however you perceive your mother to be. And then there is that inevitable moment where you think, I wonder who else she is. You know, like, I wonder what books she reads. And I wonder if she's happy with her life. And I wonder what she thinks of Dad. And, you know.
All those questions you would have liked to have asked.
Yeah.
Well, they're in the book, so she can answer them.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because that the story you're reminding me of when I worked at a real estate agency for, I don't know, a week or something between college terms. And I overheard her telling this really saucy joke about, like, you know, a woman having sex with a mailman. And the whole time she was telling it, I had a pit in my stomach. Like, now it would be the same pit you would get, like, watching your kid on a high dive or a balance beam or something. And I thought, oh, my God, you are going to just face plant. I mean, you can't do this. You're not a joke teller. You don't know how to entertain. And then she killed it, and everyone laughed, and they came out of the break room and said, God, your mother, she's such a riot. And it was like, who are you talking about? There's nothing about my mother that is or has ever been funny.
Well, your mother, it's sort of like the Dr. Krasny syndrome. You got to get past certain things here. But, you know, I was struck also by something you quote her saying early on, kids should she doesn't like kids. I mean, she says
That's
children,
right?
Kids
right.
are goats. My mother said the same thing. But that children should be seen and not heard, preferably not even seen. But
yeah.
Then when you guys left, you have two brothers, I mean, she'd cry. She'd start bawling and weeping and everything. So it's the difference between, you know, what she says and what she does and that kind of complex figure and character that you were coming to grips with. And I should say that the way you come to grips with who your mother is through this odyssey that you took, leaving home and going off on an adventure. And at the heart of the story is working as a nanny for these motherless children in Australia. And it's a very poignant and moving story, I must say. In fact, I want to get into that story with you because, well, let's talk about first being a nanny that didn't quite work out.
Yeah. So I thought my friend Tracy Tuttle and I went together. I dragged her into this whole odyssey, and my whole vision was I was going to become interesting. I was going to become different and special. And then I was going to come home and write about it because I always wanted to be a writer, but I felt like I didn't have any good stories to tell yet. So I went out there, and it took maybe 2 months before like the American Express traveler's checks were starting to thin out. And we thought we better stop and make some money here, or at least stop the bleeding. So we thought it would be waitresses or bartenders or something like sexy and fun where we would meet people, a.k.a. guys, because we were 24 and that was very high on the agenda.
And I was surprised to see you actually kept count of 18 kissing 18 guys in a certain period of time. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I hope my girls didn't just hear that.
So it's in your book.
It was a very long time. It was over 13 months, girls. We got to Sydney, and then we couldn't get jobs waitressing. And so Tracy got a job for a family that had 4 kids, and all she did all day long was laundry. And I got a job for this really wealthy family that had this beautiful home overlooking the Sydney Harbor and the Opera House. And I thought I had totally gamed the system. And then on the second day, the woman asked me to scrub her pool tiles. And I asked if that was in addition to nannying. And then the next morning at breakfast, she said that she had never hired an American. They usually hired Asians, and that I was actually quite old for them, and that maybe I was a little too unionized, which I didn't even know what the word unionized meant, to be honest. And then she said, so we think maybe this isn't going to work out and you can pack up and leave.
But then fast forward, you have this wonderful experience as a nanny with these 2 kids. One, the young boy who adores you almost from the start, and the young girl who's very resistant, doesn't want a mother surrogate or a mother replacement. And that story is very compelling. But then you meet the first employer in a grocery store.
Yes. I bump back into the lady who fired me, and I just have this surge of what I can only describe as my mother's way. You know, my mother is not someone to be trifled with. Nobody ever gets one over on my mom. And as a child, as a teenager, that is mortifying. To see your mother fight with somebody over a car payment or, you know, somebody who didn't do the gutters right and haven't come right back out. And you better not think I'm going to pay you twice. You know, it's just like you're dying inside. But then here I was face to face with this woman who I felt had behaved badly. And I just had to go eyeball to eyeball with her. And so I did. I got in the aisle with her and I said, "Hi, you don't remember me? Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm the American. I came to your house. I lived with you for 2 days. Remember you fired me?" And I thought, I'm so out of control.
You know what this reminds me of? You know Nancy Friday, who did a book called My Mother and Myself?
Oh, yeah.
That's what you're saying, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. But it was the first time that seeing a little bit of her inside me didn't alarm me. It was kind of like a rush of pride. I mean, I felt kind of arm in arm with her in that moment. And more now. I mean, I actually think that her values are excellent. So, you know, back when I was a teenager, the fact that she was wearing like the same pair of black elastic waistband pants from Macy's from like 1978 was torture to me. But now I think, God bless you. Like, you're nobody's fool. You're not running around trying to keep up with fashion. Who cares? I mean, her great line to me was, "Oh, for God's sake, Kelly, who's looking at you?" And I think that's a great sense to have in the world that you doesn't, you know, nobody's looking at you. There's 7 billion people here. Do whatever you want.
Talking to Kelly Corrigan, author of Glitter and Glue, and that's right from her mother, right from the wisdom of her mother, saying, "Well, I'm the gold, but your father is I'm the glue, but your father is the glitter," which also sort of says a lot about her role and about the role that you came to understand as mothering these kids in Australia. And let's talk about that whole experience for you and what it meant for you, because it's transformative.
It was probably the first like mature experience of my life, right? So you're in high school and everything's about you and your grades, and then you're in college and you're just so full of yourself and your sorority and the party that you're trying to get to on Friday night and your Benetton sweaters and Mia flats, and it's all kind of a joke, right? And the people that I was drawn to over those years were always the glitter, never the glue, right? Always the person who can tell the joke or had the dance move.
No, no, wait a minute. Your mother could tell a joke well,
that's too. Right. That's, but I didn't know that at that point. And then I got to Australia, and I was in this very quiet house with these introverted people that were doing very difficult work, which was transitioning from one kind of life to a totally different kind of life. And I had to slow way, way, way down. I had many hours on my hands to think and reflect. These kids were very curious about my mother, so they were always asking me to tell them stories about things I got in trouble for, or little lies I told, or where I went for my vacations with my mom. And
did you tell them about the slap?
Yeah, I did not tell them about the slap. I didn't want them to lose respect for me as a shoplifter. Boy, that's a word you could accidentally say wrong. And I thought, this is a very adult life I'm living right now. Like, this is real. You know, there's all these speeches in college where they tell you that you're a young adult now and the world is your oyster and you need to get out there and do things. And, you know, that's a lot of hype. I mean, really hard work is family life. I mean, staying and doing that work day in and day out, making people, making young citizens, making people that can thrive in the world, that have a shot at happiness, that is powerful work.
And it's also work that really you come to appreciate, understand, and validate. I mean, it's like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz a little bit. I mean, you go on this journey and you come back to there's no place like family and home.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gone a long way out of your way to get to a short place
ahead, exactly.
As Edward Albee once said. But here you are, you know, really mothering these children and taking care of them and having to essentially fill the vacancy in their lives, which is profound. They've lost their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And learning what it's like really to be a mother and to fulfill the role that your mother has fulfilled for you. And it becomes, as you know, a very transformative experience. I'm wondering just about the tools you use, because clearly you were keeping a diary, you were keeping a journal and so forth. So you had the ability to turn all of that into gold, so to speak. I mean, that's the book, right? It's based on all the...
I have really detailed journals. And then I have Tracy's journals. So we
talked. Your friend kept journals too?
Yeah. And then I also have, interestingly, letters that I sent home during that year and that my mother saved, which is so surprising to me because I would think that that would be the move of a nostalgic, sentimental woman. And I don't think of my mother in those terms, but yet the letters are there. It's an amazing list of things that a day as a mother requires. Like, there's a lot of small stuff that's trivial but yet must be done, right? You got to hand in the permission slips and you got to pack the lunch and you got to get some sunscreen on their nose and that sort of stuff. And then there's all this big stuff, right? There's negotiating the relationship between these two kids, helping them communicate with their father, all the unsaid stuff, affection and looking and listening and eye contact and the things that, you know, create a sense of security in the world and a sense that someone cares about you deeply and that you're safe. And then there's watching them in a pool, and then there's getting their friends back home and driving on the right side of the road, which I had a few troubles with over in Australia. So it's kind of an amazing job when you think about the range of things that you're required to be pretty good at every single day.
Well, there are a range of things also in addition to mothering that you bring to light in this book. I mean, there's a whole running commentary on Willa Cather's My Antonia and on the soap operas of Santa Barbara, which I kind of liked. I mean, that you keep us sort of glued to those experiences that you're going through. But also being an American in Australia and experiencing, you know, some comments that sometimes are, get you a little bit into your own patriotic feelings.
Yeah, it was interesting. So, you know, you have to leave home before you understand how American you are. So I had this photograph of my family, and everyone who looked at it would say, oh, my God, you guys are so American. And I didn't even know what I couldn't even process that,
right? Is
that
the photo that's in the book with your brothers wearing jerseys?
Exactly.
And
he's got the white out under his eye, you know, the sun glare. And, you know, that's the first time you realize you, too, have an accent. And I just remember it was the summer of Euro Disney. So everybody was just having a field day talking about how we were cultural pollutants to Europe. And it just starts to get under your skin after a while. And I likened it in the book to, you know, people used to rip on my mom a lot. And it gets under your skin after a while. It's like, yes, I understand. Like, we make mistakes. We're a quirky people. She's a strange woman. But she's mine. And this is my country. And I do have some kind of base level patriotism about this woman and this country.
You want to talk about that incident with your mother when you were 13? The graffiti incident?
So there's this kid. I don't know what's become of him, but he really disliked my mother.
Might be listening.
That's right. If you're listening, you're in trouble, mister. And he really disliked my mother. I think he was a kid that kind of got away with murder. And in her house, she ruled supreme. So there were words that you didn't say in our house. You didn't roll your eyes. If you didn't say thank you for the dinner, you didn't get invited back. And so this kid really had it up to here with my mom. And we had something this kid wanted. We had a flat backyard where all these guys could come and play Shirts and Skins football with my brothers. And so, you know, after a while of this kid being a pain, my mom said, I don't want him playing in the football games. And so one day we're driving home from school and we go underneath these train tracks on the way to our house. And on the concrete, this kid has spray painted in big black letters, "The witch is having a sale. Brooms, $1, 168 Wooded Lane," which was our address. And we passed under this thing and I read it and it was the slow dawning of, oh my God, Mom, that is you. And she said, I don't care one iota what that boy thinks of me. And I thought, I do. I care. Like, I'm 13 years old. I hardly care about anything else but what people think of you and Dad and GT and Booker. Like, my whole reputation is riding on this. We've got to act. And she just was so unflustered by it. And I was just reflecting on that now and so insanely impressed that she was the adult, you know? I mean, not all adults are adults around kids. Sometimes adults around kids become kids.
Well, I think the phrase you use is protective wrath.
Yes. I had protective wrath for her, the kind that generally mothers are said to. You know, it was like a mother bear moment where I was like, nobody does that to my mom.
Well, and now you say it probably about your own daughters. I mean, this has made you a better mm-hmm. mother, this whole experience in Australia, the writing of this book, realizing what you've been through and processing it and synthesizing it.
I mean, I think, you know, everybody comes to this realization at some point that maybe you're not going to live forever. Maybe you're not going to get 85 years. And the opening salvo in that for me was being a nanny for these kids. And then I had melanoma in my 20s, and then I had a big, bad breast cancer in my 30s. And so I think that the combination of those experiences helps me to perceive my life with these kids as, you know, something that's a blessing that I hope I get the full ride, but I don't expect it. And I don't necessarily, it's never lost on me that maybe you don't get the whole thing.
Talking to Kelly Corrigan again, her book is Glitter and Glue, and this is an interactive program. So we welcome your involvement in it. In fact, if you're a reader of hers and you'd like to join us, or if you have some thoughts about motherhood, which is really what we're talking about and what the book is about and about what it means to understand the nature of, well, what it means to be a mother, we certainly welcome your thoughts, welcome your joining the conversation. You can do that now toll-free, and our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your call. So again, feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments you might have onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, we welcome your involvement. Kelly Corrigan's book is Glitter and Glue. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Kelly Corrigan. Your father is the glitter and I am the glue. That's what her mother used to tell her about her mother's ability to keep the family together. And in her new memoir, Glitter and Glue, she reflects on the complicated relationship she had with her mother and what she learned about motherhood when she was a live-in nanny for a widower in Australia and when she eventually had her own children. And you're certainly welcome to join our conversation. The toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or you can email us. especially if you have some reflections about, well, the transgenerational things what interests me in this, you know, learning about mothering from mothers and learning about mothering your own children through your own mother and how that filters down and what filters down, particularly in the view of mothers and the jobs that they do. And, you know, the jobs are pretty extraordinary and certainly unsung in too many ways. What also is unsung maybe is Kelly Corrigan's work for Notes and Words, which I think I mentioned in my introduction. And that's a big deal in Oakland, and you're kind of the co-founder. So let's say something about that.
So Notes and Words is writers and musicians on stage together. We have three writers, and they do short reading, maybe 5 minutes, and they talk for 5 minutes. And then they alternate with musical acts. So this year we have the great Jane Smiley, Pulitzer Prize winner for 1,000 Acres. I think she's written 13 other books. And then Jim Gaffigan, who's a comedian who just had a bestseller called Dad is Fat, which was his son's first sentence. And then I'll be reading. And then on the musical side, we have the number one high school a cappella singing group in the United States. They're called Vocal Rush. And then a really cool funk band called Midtown Social. And then we have a secret surprise headliner that's a big Bay Area K-Fog favorite. And I think he's going to thrill everybody. And
it's what's the date?
May 3rd at the Paramount Theater, and everything benefits Children's Hospital Oakland. And this is our fifth annual, and we've already raised almost $4 million.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
I want it's called Notes and Words. And I was going to ask you, we're going to get our callers involved in this, but about your faith, I mean, Catholicism. Mm-hmm. You touch on it in the book, and what interested me again was kind of the transgenerational notion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to church and you feel a kind of comfort and connection with your mother, and going mm-hmm. to church, so you probably don't have the strength of her faith or the belief or the conviction.
Absolutely. I mean, my parents are they go to church every single day. Really? It is the center of their lives, and they wish it for us so much, and in really the healthiest, most loving way. It's just a source of great comfort and guidance to them, and they wish the same for us. So it's not like a pride thing, like I want all my kids to be Catholic so I can tell everybody at church that, you know, my kids, all their kids are getting their first communion, et cetera. It's really just, what are you doing in the middle of the night, honey? If you don't have the church, like, where do you go with your worries? And we don't go to church that much, although in all the big moments, I have returned home, so to speak. So I was married in the church of my childhood at Villanova in Villanova, Pennsylvania, right now the university. And then when it was time to baptize Georgia 12 years ago, it was this long, really hard decision. And we did it. And we went through all the conversations with a local priest here at Berkeley, where they practice Catholicism slightly differently than they do in Villanova. Let me tell you.
Understatement.
Yeah. Yes. Amazing. I always wanted my mom to sit and talk with this man. But then during her baptism, I got so emotional. I just couldn't keep it together. And it was just that, you know, I must really love my mother because that's why I'm here.
Remember a story, just a little footnote, that John Gregory Dunn's wife, famous mm-hmm. Joan Didion, told mm-hmm. about how they considered themselves atheists, and she was Presbyterian, he was Catholic, but he wanted nothing to do with the church and was very critical of the church. When they adopted their daughter, Quintana Roo, he actually, without her knowing it, snuck Quintana Roo to have a baptism.
Wow. I mean, that
story tells volumes to me about how these mm-hmm. things carry on.
And how it's complicated.
And how
complicated. Like, I don't know if I can discuss Catholicism, although I love the new pope, but I don't know if I can discuss Catholicism without getting frustrated with it. But put me in a pew, and, like, chances are 50-50 that I'm going to get choked up. So what's that? I don't know.
Well, it may have a lot to do with your childhood. It may have a lot to do with your mother and father and so forth. But I want to ask you also about this book has a romance in it, too. Young man named Evan who lives in this household that you become part of. There are actually two, a young man and old man, Evan and somebody named Pop, who were related not by blood but to the first wife who died.
That's right.
Who had another husband before the airline employee that you go to work for, Mr. Tanner. And I was just interested in, using that in the book the way you did. I mean, it's part of the whole landscape of the book mm-hmm. And certainly part of your experience. But then, I don't want to give too much away here, but what were you thinking?
I guess I was thinking that part of what happens when you really care, come to care about people, is that you want to help them. And help can sometimes bleed into wanting to fix them. And so in this house was this old man whose daughter had just died, right? And then her second husband, and then her son, Evan, from her first marriage, and then these two little kids. And so the little kids, you know, I wanted to like hem Millie's nightgown and paint her toenails. And the little boy, I wanted to fix his chap lips. He had those super crusty red chap lips. And I was just obsessed with like getting that right before I left. And for the widower, I wanted to sort out his kitchen and get rid of a bunch of bizarre stuff that should have been thrown away and clear out the cookbooks and, you know, make things right in his home. And then this boy had totally gone internal. You know, he had this very quiet life, very isolated. He worked from 11 p.m. until 5 in the morning stocking grocery shelves. And then he just kind of sat out there.
So you call him a boy, though, rather than a young man.
He was a young man. He felt like a boy to me. I felt like a girl, too. So, yeah, no distinction between us that way. And, you know, he was just isolated, and I just wanted to bring him back to life, you know? And
well, you're very empathic, I mean, toward, you know, his loss of a mother and his I was just, well, a little surprised when you try to reach, I won't give this away or anything, but got back in touch with him after the book was done and so forth.
Well, there's a coda to that.
Oh?
So we'll just blow this for the listener. So this boy, this who I just really cared about so much, I tried to get back in touch with him while I was writing this book. So years ago, I'm trying to find this person. And you would think in today's world that you could find anybody in about 10 minutes. But the real names of these people are super common. And so I was just – every search was yielding like hundreds of people with no birth dates, so no way to distinguish. And so finally I find somebody on LinkedIn that has his real name. And I reach out to him and the guy says – and I reach out maybe six or seven times. And finally the guy says – hey, I'm sorry I've been out of touch. I've been going through a bit of a hard time, but you have my blessing. And that's it. And I can't get any other emails from him. And it was all very strange.
No information about the family?
None.
Nothing, yeah.
And I mean, this caused me tremendous stress, as you can imagine, right? That I'm going to go to print with this book having not been able to find the people that occupy at least 100 pages of it. And so I'm stewing and I'm stewing. I hire a private detective. A second one, the first one was a bust. I find the girl. I write her. I connect with her. I send her books. I get a note back. It's wonderful. Then, not 2 weeks ago, the real Evan sends me a 9-paragraph email. And he says, I just finished reading Glitter and Glue. Or I should say, you just finished reading it to me. Because I live in Sweden and I have an hour commute every day. And I bought the audiobook. And I've been listening to you at 5 in the morning, your voice coming out of my radio, telling me the story of 1992, which I hardly remember at all. It's a huge blur. And I loved it.
Yeah, that must have elevated your spirit tremendously.
Oh, I'm done. I'm out.
That's a happy story.
Yeah, this is a success, officially.
And there's also a happy feeling and some very elevated emotional feelings, especially in your relationship with the children, but particularly the girl, because she's so resistant at first. And there's one moment where she just puts her head down on you that's really so tender and sweet. Let me bring our callers in. And we go first to Colleen. Good morning.
Oh, hi. This is Colleen. Hi, Kelly. I've seen you speak a couple times. And to the point you were just making, I really do feel like you write just like you speak. And when I first read Middle Place, I definitely felt a connection to you. And I just wanted to talk about one line in the book that really touched me. When you say, what child can see the woman inside her mom? What with all that motherness blocking out everything else? And I have three boys, and I spend so much time sort of keeping down the crazy that it's hard for them to know the fun, silly person that I am, because if I get too silly, then it's crazy in here. So anyway, that book, that line just really resonated with me, and I think a lot of other moms too, because it's hard for a child to know every facet of who we are.
Yeah.
So,
and it takes a lot, really long time for a child to become curious about the other facets of your personality. One thing I think is I always want to have girlfriends around when my kids, I want my kids to stay in the kitchen when my girlfriends pop over for a cup of tea or a glass of wine, because I want them to see me with my girlfriends, not only because I want to model friendship for them and make sure that they know how to do that because it's sort of so central to happiness. But also I know that I look different and all my expressions are different and my body language is different. And there's just a total relaxation that comes over me when a friend is in the house. And
you
want
them
to
see your
that.
Other selves.
Yes.
Exactly. Completely.
Absolutely.
And I can see my boys looking at me differently too when I'm caught. And they're like, oh my gosh, there's all these other things she knows about and mm-hmm. talks about and is interested in. So anyway, just love that part. Love the whole book. Love you. Can't wait to see what you write next. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Colleen. Good to hear from you. We'll go right on to another caller, and that's Yvette in Berkeley. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I haven't read the book, but just listening to you, I'll probably go out and get it. But I was calling because of some of the things you said a little earlier about, you know, your mom didn't get ruffled when the boy had written on the cement calling her a witch. And it put me into a thought of the experience with my friends and their children and how what I'm seeing around me is so much disrespect towards elders and people, and that's not really being taught to children, the modeling of behavior, a consistent way of raising your children, knowing that everything is teaching them or putting them, sorry, I'm in my car, preparation for adulthood and how you interact with other people on every level. And your example is the best.
It's so relentless, the amount of coaching / correcting that's required to get a kid to speak respectfully. I mean, because it's got to start with you, right? Which means that almost every day you're having to say, Georgia, you cannot talk to me like that. Claire, that is not an okay way to talk. Like, and if you really are on it, you might be critiquing their delivery, you know, a dozen times a day. But you got to hope that over some number of years, it'd be fun to come up with an average.
We could wax a little sentimental about the way, you know, adults used to get more respect from children and all of that. But I remember, for example, you grew up in Philadelphia. I grew up in Cleveland. But it was commonplace to call neighbors Mr. or Mrs.
I know.
And that has been vanquished in California almost completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it still goes on to a minor extent. But usually kids call their parents' friends by their first name.
Yes.
They call their neighbors by their first names and so forth. I don't know if that's important or not. You know, sometimes I kind of muse on that. Is it trivial or not? What do you think?
I think it would be better if we called everybody Mr. and Mrs. I really do.
Okay, then you can still call me Doctor.
Yeah.
Here's Rosie who writes, when she was interviewed at City Arts and Lectures with Anna Quinlan, she didn't get enough of a chance to elaborate on her thoughts about ambition. I thought she was quite compelling in her feelings about ambition and wanted to hear more. If you have time, I'd love to hear more about from her about this.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess, so I'm 46 and I am just sort of tracking internally the way that my ambition is changing over time. So, you know, it used to be that I would whip off a list on Monday morning of, you know, 55 things that I was going to do that week that were going to, you know, move the needle, move the puck down the ice, just in these teeny little increments. And now I find on Monday morning that I'm just drinking my coffee and staring out the window, and I'll start to think of a dozen things that I could do to help Glitter and Glue find more readers, let's say. And then I'll just dismiss them one by one in my mind, like, what's it worth? You know, it's just like 10 more people, 100 more people. Like, and so that's what I was trying to ask Anna, and also about Anna's character in that book, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, is what happens? Is it when you start to feel your ambition wane, and is it something that we should welcome or something that we should fight? And I just don't know, you know, I don't want to drop out before my time. And so maybe it's just my experiences so far tell me that a lot of the 55 things that might be on my list are actually going to be a bunch of scrambling around for not much. So maybe I'm more discerning, or it might just be that I just don't have as much fight in me as I did 10 years ago.
Well, you got to laugh in that interview with Anna Quinlan. He said, I was Michael Krasny's student and he advised me maybe perhaps not to be a writer. A little laugh at my expense, but those things... But
you were concerned. You were concerned about me.
Well, I like to think I'm concerned about all my students, especially the brighter ones. But there's a moment in the book where you come through in terms of your education and literature. I don't believe it was in my class, but you mentioned reader response criticism.
Yeah.
And you talk about it and define it in a pretty, I think, useful and sensible way. It just means that you are everything that affects you in a work, and you bring that to the work.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I was thinking about My Antonia because my mom so loved that book, and I had never read it because I didn't take my mom's suggestions, and also it was sometimes assigned in school, so that was 2 marks against it. And then I was in this tiny house with so many hours on my hands, and I was reading it, and I was loving it. And I just wondered, what impact does it have that I'm reading this book here and now, living in a house, a motherless home, so far away from my mother, who's so on my mind and who loved this, feeling, you know, kind of nostalgic anyway. And it's quite a sentimental story. And then remembering that it was something we learned about in school, that, you know, a book isn't a book. A book is what you think a book is. And every reader is going to have their own response to it. And that response is driven by all sorts of things, like their age and who gave them the book. And was it raining the day they finished the last chapter? And did their back ache that day? Or did they read it on a vacation? Or were they drinking when they read it? You know, or what
So who books... needs more readers? They're That's all going right. to be different anyway, right?
That's right. No, it's cool that they're all different. I love hearing what people respond to.
Let's hear some more responses. We'll go to Phyllis next. Hi, Phyllis.
Oh, hi. Two things about your talk. Several things are interesting, but it especially spoke to me. First of all, even after being a Berkeley grad, I went to San Francisco State grad school and had the best professor I ever had in creative writing. I can't remember his name, unfortunately, but it wasn't you, Dr. Krasny. Pardon me. I can't remember his name. He worked with Saul Vance at one time with Fantasy Records. Do you have any idea who he was?
No.
Well, anyway, that doesn't matter. But he said the great thing. And
but Phyllis, you're right in line with what often happens. Somebody will say, I had the greatest teacher, the greatest writer. I said, who was? I can't remember the name.
Or with books, they say, I read the greatest book. And I'll say, who wrote it? And they say, I don't know.
Or what happens all the time in terms of working on radio is people will say, I listened to the program and I was so fascinated. Who was I talking to? What was the subject? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Phyllis, go ahead.
The great thing that he said. So I wrote a short story in the class, and he read it, and he said, well, that was well written, Phyllis, but I don't believe it. And I said, but it really happened. And he said, but art is to be better than life. Otherwise, just read the newspapers. And I thought, that is so good. So, but that makes it hard when you're writing memoir, because it really happened. How do you make it artful? It has to have insight, I guess. Or what do you think about that, please?
I think it's, I think the greatest tool you have as a memoirist is sequence. So, you know, life unfolds chronologically, but you have these options to move things around, and somehow that can create tensions.
Start in the middle of things.
You could shuffle things together. So Glitter and Glue is a really shuffled story between my life as my mom's daughter and my life as these kids' nanny.
But you keep us with the story of the nanny. You keep us, and you also keep us in suspense to some extent over your own health, because you begin with your having the diagnosis. And I'm sorry, Phyllis, go ahead.
So you get the insight from the order of the sequence, because that's what I, you know, how do you make it? I guess insight into what's happening is what makes this artful out of a story. I mean, you can just tell a story.
Also, you have to put things in the pages that you wouldn't necessarily talk about with friends. So you have to say more than is typically shared between friends. Otherwise, it's really not worth it. So there is the story, there is what happened, and then there is how you felt about it. And when you're talking about how you felt about it, there can be great revelation there that really makes it worthwhile and meaty and satisfying for a reader.
And for you as a writer.
Yes.
Let me thank the caller. Getting some interesting emails here. Jane says, you never know what you're going to elicit. She said, my husband and I have difficult siblings. One of our goals as parents has been to raise siblings who can have good relationships as adults when we are gone. And here's Lisa who writes, I was driving home from dropping my daughter off at school, and I was laughing out loud. My daughter is turning 14 this summer, and I can see that I will have to be less her friend and more her mother if I'm going to protect her, teach her, and help her become the woman I know she can be. Saying no is something her friends' parents don't seem to do, and so I've already become the bad guy. Your stories are so familiar and feel like home. My mother had no problem saying no. She was a single mother and did not have time for trouble, naughty friends, eye-rolling, or late curfews, and now as a mother, I understand, can't wait to get your book. Well, I think it's important for parents to say no. And I got to say, maybe I just had my daughter in from out of town and we're talking, reflecting about the past and so forth. And when she really disliked me and my wife for kind of standing up to her or thought we were the enemy, she was really, it turned out, going through a phase, as other people told me and as I wanted to believe, and as now I understand to be the case, and stood firm, you know, on a lot of things that required standing firm on. And now she's grateful, as I think you are to your mother, even though she was tough.
I so remember being in college and sitting around with a bunch of girlfriends and hearing stories about their moms who were pushovers or suckers, or like they could steal their mom's credit card and use it and put it back in her wallet and she'd never know the difference. Or
drink or use drugs and have their parents not interfere or not try to stop them.
Yeah. And I remember, I don't know what I conveyed, but I remember inside feeling a little bit of pride. Like that would never happen in our house. There's no way that anybody would pull that off with Mary Corrigan at the helm. And I think that's impressive. I mean, now I think she's insanely admirable. You know, I mean, one of the ways that I talk about the book is that it's the difference between liking someone and loving someone. Which, you know, you think love is just a whole lot of like, and then it tips over into love. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you don't have to like someone to love someone.
No, I agree. But you like and love your mother now. That's pretty clear. Let me get some more calls on. We go to Reno and Nancy. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
It's Nancy in Reno. Hey, this is kind of a follow-up question about being a memoirist. So how do you write freely and tell the truth in your writing while protecting your family if you're dealing with hard topics or difficult memories or even, you know, mental illness or how things really went and your parents are still alive and your siblings are still alive? How do you?
It's very, very difficult. And I have always bowed to family over work. So when in doubt, I don't put it in. And, you know, there may be... there may be a reason why you have to turn to somebody like Mary Carr, who is really willing to put it all on the page. But it's very dicey business. And I had decided from the get-go, you know, I was very old when I was sort of old when I got into this thing. I was 40 years old when The Middle Place came out. And there was just no way that I was going to trade in, my family harmony for just a slightly juicier book. And it wasn't what the book was about to me anyway. So it wasn't, that wasn't the point, was to expose anything. The point was to talk about very specific themes, you know. So in this book, it's really about acceptance and what that looks like and what it takes to get there and then how difficult it is to stay there. And so that drives the content. And so it may not be necessary if there's something that you want to talk about or think through on the page, it may not be necessary to tell stories that would be difficult for others to read because they may not aid your project.
I think a good rule of thumb is get permission. I mean, run it past people. That's what, for example, I had this conversation once with Isabel Allende, and she said everybody, when she wrote a memoir, had to give their stamp of approval, as opposed to Nuala O'Fallon, the Irish writer, who... In many ways, I've always admired. She's deceased now, but she said, you know, it came out of me. It should be in there. I don't need approval from anyone. I own it if I've written it. And her family stopped talking to her. Okay, here's Christy who writes, I became a mom later in life after 38 years of being child-free. It has been a huge struggle for me to deal with my own issues with impatience, anger, and selfishness. I've been thinking a lot about the mom I want my son to have. I often think about how I want to be so different from my own mom. Kelly is making me think a lot about the fact that I should be less critical of my mom. She was very young, isolated, and financially troubled woman struggling to keep a family together. I'm appreciating her more today.
Oh, I'm so glad.
You're being Johnny Appleseed here with mothers. Yeah. And we'll bring another caller on the air, and that's Bonnie. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My name is Bonnie. I'm calling from Saratoga. I'm a big fan of yours, Kelly, and you're so great about connecting with your audience and making everyone feel like they're your friend. And thanks for being that voice out there for all of us. You're also a great supporter of other writers and great causes, and I was curious to know what your top three pieces of advice are for aspiring writers, and also how does a writer know that their story is compelling? Do you pick you just said this story is about acceptance. Do you typically have one theme, or do you typically tie a few together? So there's a few questions there, but
yep.
I'll throw it back at you.
So I only have one piece of advice for aspiring writers, which is write every day. You have to open the document every day. Even if you only sit with it for 20 or 30 minutes, I think it's so valuable in terms of keeping it in your conscience, keeping it front of mind, and it allows you to sort of collect little nuggets over the course of your day that are somehow related to what you were just working on this morning. This is advice that I do not follow, so it is only something that I wish I did. But you really do have to write every day to keep it banging around in your mind at all times. You know, you have to be in the line of fire, so to speak. And then the second thing is, I don't think that you would know for a good 100, 150 pages. You might not even know until like a third draft what it's really about for you. So you're just going to have to start telling the stories that you remember best and trust that there's a reason that you remember them. You know, there's a reason that some stories are easier to tell with great detail and color than others. And eventually you will figure out what that is and it will be compelling.
Good note to end on. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. Again, the book is Glitter and Glue by Kelly Corrigan, my most famous former student other than Annette Bening. Good to have you here. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can, by the way, continue this conversation online by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. A lot of important and, I think, valuable topics of what Kelly calls the strongest currency of all, maternal love. That's apropos the last hour we did on Bitcoin. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.